Our lesson for today takes us to chapter 24 of the Acts of the Apostles. Chapter 24. This continues with the record of Paul as a prisoner and how he is permitted to bear his testimony before those who occupied high places. In the first 9 verses of this chapter, we are introduced to the accusation against Paul. Verses 10 through 21, there is the record of the address of Paul, what he said in answer for himself. Verses 23 through 27, the attitude of Felix, the governor. Let us read then what is said against Paul, the accusations laid against him. Verse 1. After 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders, and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always, and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness, notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency a few words. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law. But the chief captain, Lysias, came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come unto thee, by examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him." And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so. Now let us examine these things a little now and put yourself in the atmosphere of the High Court. Here now this special governor is going to act as judge. And from Jerusalem there comes down the high priest and with him a few others. Quite an impressive group make up this party. High priest no doubt in charge, and he brings with him a number of the elders. Now you would have thought that these in themselves would be sufficient. Surely if a man was qualified to sit as high priest, and others qualified to be the elders, that is the rulers in the city, surely they themselves could have presented their case. But it seems not. They hired a lawyer, a man who was a great orator, a man who knew how to put it over. So they hire this lawyer to present the case eloquently. And so when the time comes, Paul is there, and the governor is there, and the high priest is there, the elders are all gathered, this orator rises to make his impressive speech. First of all, it's marked by a flowery exaggeration of words in order to impress the governor. And I suppose he wanted to carry favor for those making the accusation against Paul. But we should remember this, that it's no use using flowery words if you've got the truth. Truth will stand against all the eloquence of the accuser. The second thing to be noted in the speech by the lawyer is the obvious distortion of facts, as outlined in verse 7. He says, "But the chief captain, Lysias, came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands." That wasn't true. In fact, it's doubtful if he was there that day. He's only saying here in this court scene what others perhaps have told him. It's doubtful if he even was there that day when Paul was being examined. However, he's putting it over in such a way that he seeks to impress the governor. Then again, the main point in the charge is the misrepresentation of Paul. Three things should be noted. He is charged as being a troublesome pest. That's what it means there when they say what they found him. You see, he was not a troublesome pest at all. Paul was a man who was just going around his business. He was doing what the Lord commanded him to do, but he says he was a pestilent fellow. That is, a troublesome pest. Is a man a troublesome pest because he's a preacher of the gospel? But now that is what he tells them here, tells the governor. Then he says he's likely to stir up rebellion against the power of Rome. Well, that wasn't true. You see, he was neither a pestilent fellow, he wasn't a troublesome pest, and he was not a mover of sedition at all. The fact of the matter is that when Christianity is properly lived, Christians should be the most law-abiding citizens in any country. Christians don't normally go out deliberately to break the law. If they're living as Christians, they will be law-abiding citizens. But he says this man is likely to stir up rebellion against the power of Rome. Then religiously, he is charged with being a ringleader of a new Jewish sect called the Nazarenes. That's what this great orator says. He's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Then the third charge is that he attempted to violate the sanctity of their holy temple. Now you see, after all, Paul was none of these things. He was not a pestilent fellow. He wasn't stirring up sedition. He wasn't against the law. And another thing is this, he did not go in to profane the temple. However, these are the things that the orator lays against him. But when you come to verse 10, you're introduced now to Paul's reply to these men. Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned unto him to speak, answered, "Forasmuch as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge in this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues nor in the city. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. But this I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and unjust. And herein do I exercise myself, to have always a conscience void of offence toward God and toward men. Now after many years I came to bring alms to my nation and offerings, whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult, who ought to have been here before thee and object, if they had aught against me. Or else, let these same here say, if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council. Except it be for this one voice, that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day. And when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them and said, when Lysias the chief captain shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter. Now, you see, here again, we are brought face to face with what Paul had to say in defense of himself. You know, a straightforward account is an honest man's best defense, because it is the knowledge and not the ignorance of the judge that safety will lie. You see, if you can tell the truth, the judge is there. He's able to listen to both sides. If one man is telling falsehoods and the other man just simply tells the truth, the judge would have to put both into the balance. And so again I remind you that a straightforward account is an honest man's best defense, because it is in the knowledge and not the ignorance of the judge that safety will lie. So Paul spoke cheerfully. He knew he was defending a good cause. There's no need for him to be upset. He knew that his cause was just, so he spoke cheerfully. But he also spoke very skillfully. Even if the cause is good and right, one will not be excused for using bad or weak arguments. You must put your argument over in a strong manner. It must be put skillfully. And of course Paul, being a man also educated with languages and in the law, he was able to stand up against this orator who was accusing him, and he was able to state the facts. He knew the facts. He was a true witness. The other man was still simply making a speech out of the things he had been told. But Paul spoke very skillfully. Not only so, I suggest to you that Paul presented his case confidently. Hasn't God already told him that he's going to testify in Rome? So he knows that one way or another he's going to be in Rome. So Paul presented his case confidently. Having already been tried by the great judge called Conscience and was acquitted, he could speak with confidence now to this man who was called Felix. So therefore he was able to give his speech to this great governor. So he could speak confidently. But I suggest to you that Paul pressed his case defiantly. He proved conclusively that what was true in the charge was not criminal, and the things that were criminal in the charges were not true. Besides, why aren't the witnesses present? You know, it's one thing to make a charge, but the judge will say, well, where are the witnesses? You need to have your witnesses in order to prove the charge. So therefore Paul says, where are the witnesses? If the witnesses can be found, why don't you bring them here? And of the men who are here with this party, and the men who have hired this orator, if they are real witnesses to the case, why don't they step forward and give their witness? Let us hear what they've got to say. And so he really pressed his case defiantly, showing that what they were doing was not according to the terms of law. But I suggest he rested his case triumphantly. Now, I want to draw attention again to the fact that when the opportunity was given Paul to speak on this occasion, he said that when he went up to Jerusalem, he did go into the temple, that's true, but not to stir up trouble. He said, I worship God in a way that they call heresy. But if they call it heresy, remember this, I'm only worshipping God in the way that our fathers did, believing all things which were written in the law and in the prophets. Now therefore, when you come to verse 15, he presses this issue. And have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow. Now if I'm wrong in preaching and believing in the resurrection, they must also be wrong. But they believe this, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and unjust. And so he presses again this great truth of the resurrection. Then he lets them know why he had come to Jerusalem. He had come there not to get anything and not to cause trouble. He came there in order to bring with him some money to help the poor people in Jerusalem. But then again, he presses this thing right down in verse 21, except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day. Now notice, twice on this occasion, he raises this great truth of the resurrection. I suggest that he rested his case here triumphantly. See, he reached the point where he submitted the doctrine of the resurrection. And the moment he came to that point, he rested his case. See, these people who really were accusing him, they were people who professedly believed in the resurrection. That is the Pharisees. The Sadducees, you will remember, were those who denied it. So he raises again the great issue of the resurrection. Might I at this point press home upon all my listeners today that the great cardinal point of all apostolic preaching throughout the Acts of the Apostles has been this great truth of the resurrection. Do you recall in our first lesson from chapter 1 where we learned this great truth? But ye shall receive power after the Holy Spirit has come upon you. Ye shall be witnesses unto me both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and in Samaria and unto the uttermost part of the earth. They were to be his witnesses. Witnesses for what? Witnesses concerning the resurrection. For when Peter stood up amongst them, when they were waiting for the great day of Pentecost to come, then he said this: Wherefore of these men which have companied with us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning from the baptism of John unto that same day that he was taken up from us, must one be ordained to be a witness with us of his resurrection? Again, I remind you, that was the cardinal point in all apostolic preaching. You had to get your audience to the point of the resurrection. And may I remind all my listeners today, this is still the great cardinal point in the presentation of the gospel and in preaching and presenting Jesus Christ to the audience. If we fail to let them know that the Christ who died is now alive, that he lives in the power of an indissoluble life, we fail in the vital point. You see, if Christ didn't rise again from the dead, then there's no salvation. If Christ didn't rise from the dead, we are of all men most miserable. If Christ didn't rise from the dead, we've got no hope beyond this life. But then Paul triumphantly comes to the point, now is Christ risen from the dead? And here again in Acts 24, he's saying, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day. Oh, I think I see Paul as he raised his hands on that occasion. And he rested his case triumphantly again, I say, on this great point of the doctrine of the resurrection. May I ask every listener today, is there anyone can dispute the fact that Christ is alive? I tell you this, my friend, any person who denies the physical resurrection of Christ is not a Christian. I don't care what outward profession he may make. If he denies the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, he's not a Christian, because the word says, if thou shalt confess with thy mouth Jesus is Lord, and believe in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. So Paul reached again the vital point, presenting the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, I want you to think of this man called Felix, the governor. I don't suppose he ever anticipated they would have to listen to a man like Paul preaching like this. But of course, circumstances were such that he was sitting that day on the judge's seat. He had to listen to case. And when he came to this point, why, of course, he said, now, we better bring the case to an end. So he commanded a centurion, that's a soldier in charge of another 100 soldiers, commanded the centurion to keep Paul, to let him have a certain measure of liberty, and that he should forbid none of his acquaintances to minister or come unto him. So he would have visitors, although he is to be kept as a prisoner. Now then, you'll notice at verse 24, it says, and after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. And as he reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled and answered, go thy way for this time, When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee. He hoped also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might loose him, wherefore he sent for him the oftener, and communed with him. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room, and Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left him bound. Now, I want you to notice this. The attitude of this governor to the message of Paul. The truth was declared in his hearing. The governor listened to the message dealing with righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come. That's a tremendous sermon, in small words, you would say. A great amount of truth set into small compass. He reasoned of righteousness. He reasoned of temperance. And he reasoned of judgment to come. You see, the truth was declared. I wonder, my friend, if you have ever heard reasoning on the truth of righteousness. For example, God demands a standard of righteousness, and God will never lower his standard of righteousness. The unfortunate thing is this, that mankind is unable to give the righteousness that God demands. However, there is a righteousness that has been revealed without the law. That is the righteousness that has been revealed in the gospel. And God is still righteous. And yet God can be the justifier of all them who believe in Jesus. God demands righteousness. And only the righteousness that is found in Jesus Christ will satisfy the God of heaven. Therefore you and I must be accepted by him in the person of his Son. Righteousness. Temperance. Now, temperance perhaps is used in a very narrow sense today, but here it's used in a broad sense. Not only temperance with regard to alcoholic liquor, but this is temperance in all matters. Men should be temperate. And then he speaks of judgment to come. Now, it's not popular to speak about judgment, but Paul did it then, before this governor. And when he listened to this, he trembled. This man was living in sin and would be troubled in conscience as he listened to such soul-searching truths. You know, men and women who are living in sin, they cannot suffer to listen to sermons dealing with God's standards of righteousness. They cannot suffer to listen to sermons dealing with temperance. And they certainly cannot suffer to listen to preaching that deals with coming judgment. Oh, my friend, this man trembled, and well he may. And people who are living in sin today might well tremble when they think of God's great truths of righteousness, temperance, and judgment. But this man trifled with eternal matters. He thought that he could arrange just when and how he would attend to such things. It is obvious that Felix the governor had some ulterior motive in listening to Paul, and he trifled with these great eternal issues. He trifled with them for 2 full years. Then he was moved away from office. May I ask every listener today, have you been trifling with the things of God? Have you? Notice, he hoped also that money should have been given to him of Paul. Plain words, he perhaps thought Paul was a rich man, or he thought that Paul's people were rich, or that the Christians were rich, and they might be willing to come along and pay some good bounty, and line his hands, so to speak, in order to have Paul set at liberty. He hoped also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might loose him. Thought that Paul might want to buy his freedom, whereof he sent for him the offer and communed with him. Yet it was no good. The truth was declared to this man. He trembled when he listened to the truth, but he trifled with eternal matters. I hope, my friend, as you've listened to my voice today, that you're not trifling with eternal issues. Get right with God and do it now. Get right with God. He tells you how. Oh, come to Christ who shed his blood and at the cross get right with God.